Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga.
Welcome to the 186th of the Cthulhu Podcasts. I'm FNH. Today we're starting off with the next part of Greenmantle, and then we'll have a musical number from 1929, and then on to the final part of Mr. West's uncanny career. Let's get started. Chapter 7, Christmas Tide. Everything depended on whether the servant was in the hall. I'd put Stum to sleep for a bit, but I couldn't flatter myself he'd be quiet for long. And when he came to, he'd kick the locked door to Matchwood. I must get out of the house without a minute's delay, and if the door was shut and the old man gone to bed, I was done. I met him at the foot of the stairs, carrying a candle. "Your master wants me to send off an important telegram. Where's the nearest office? There's one in the village, isn't there?" I spoke in my best German, the first time I'd used the tongue since I crossed the frontier. "The village is 5 minutes off, at the foot of the avenue," he said. "Will you be long, sir?" "I'll be back in a quarter of an hour," I said. "Don't look up till I get in." I put on my ulster and walked out into a clear, starry night. My bag I left lying on the settle in the hall. There was nothing in it to compromise me, but I wished I could have got a toothbrush and some tobacco out of it. And so began one of the craziest escapades you can well imagine. I couldn't stop to think of the future yet, but must take one step at a time. I ran down the avenue, my feet cracking on the hard snow, planning hard my programme for the next hour. I found the village, half a dozen houses with one biggish place that looked like an inn. The moon was rising, and as I approached, I saw that there was some kind of a store. A funny little two-seated car was purring before the door, and I guessed this was also the telegraph office. I marched in and told my story to a stout woman with spectacles on her nose who was talking to a young man. "It's too late," she shook her head. "The Herr Burgrave knows that well. There is no connection from here after 8 o'clock. If the matter is urgent, you must go to Schwandorf." "How far is that?" I asked, looking for some excuse to get decently out of the shop. 7 miles," she said. "But here is Franz and the post wagon. Franz, you'll be glad to give the gentleman a seat beside you." The sheepish-looking youth muttered something which I took to be assent, and finished off a glass of beer. From his eyes and manner, he looked as if he were half-drunk. I thanked the woman and went out to the car, for I was in a fever to take advantage of this unexpected bit of luck. I could hear the postmistress enjoining Franz not to keep the gentleman waiting, and presently he came out and flopped into the driver's seat. We started in a series of voluptuous curves, till his eyes got accustomed to the darkness. At first we made good going along the straight, broad highway lined with woods on one side and on the other snowy fields melting into haze. Then he began to talk, and as he talked, he slowed down. This by no means suited my book, and I seriously wondered whether I should pitch him out and take charge of the thing. He was obviously a weakling, left behind in the conscription, and I could have done it with one hand. But, by a fortunate chance, I left him alone. "That is a fine hat of yours, mein Herr," he said. He took off his own blue-peaked cap, the uniform, I suppose, of the driver of the post wagon, and laid it on his knee. The night air ruffled a shock of tow-coloured hair. Then he calmly took my hat and clapped it on his head. "With this thing I should be a gentleman," he said. I said nothing, but put on his cap and waited. "That is a noble overcoat, mein Herr," he went on. "It goes well with the hat. It is the kind of garment I have always desired to own. In 2 days it will be the holy Christmas when gifts are given. Would that the good God sent me such a coat as yours?" "You can try it on and see how it looks," I said good-humouredly. He stopped the car with a jerk and pulled off his blue coat. The exchange was soon effected. He was about my height, and my ulster fitted not so badly. I put on his overcoat, which had a big collar that buttoned around the neck. The idiot preened himself like a girl. Drink and vanity had primed him for any folly. He drove so carelessly for a bit that he nearly put us into a ditch. We passed several cottages, and at the last he slowed down. "A friend of mine lives here," he announced. "Gertrude would like to see me in the fine clothes which the most amiable Hare has given me. Wait for me, I will not be long." And he scrambled out of the car and lurched into the little garden. I took his place and moved very slowly forward. I heard the door open and the sound of laughing and loud voices. Then it shut, and looking back I saw that my idiot had been absorbed into the dwelling of his Gertrude. I waited no longer, but sent the car forward at its best speed. 5 minutes later the infernal thing began to give trouble, a nut loose on the antiquated steering gear. I unhooked a lamp, examined it, and put the mischief right, but I was a quarter of an hour doing it. The highway ran now in a thick forest, and I noticed branches going off now and then to the right. I was just thinking of turning up one of them, for I had no anxiety to visit Schwandorf, when I heard behind me the sound of a great car driven furiously. I drew in to the right side, thank goodness I remembered the rule of the road, and proceeded decorously, wondering what was going to happen. I could hear the brakes being clamped on and the car slowing down. Suddenly a great grey bonnet slipped past me, and as I turned my head, I heard a familiar voice. It was Stum, looking like something that had been run over. He had his jaw in a sling so that I wondered if I'd broken it, and his eyes were beautifully bunged up. It was that saved me, that and his raging temper. The collar of the postman's coat was round my chin, hiding my beard, and I had his cap pulled well down over my brow. I remembered that Blenkeron had said that the only way to deal with Germans was naked bluff. Mine was naked enough, for it was all that was left to me. "Where is the man that brought you from Andersbach?" he roared, as well as his jaw would allow him. I pretended to be mortally scared, and spoke in the best imitation I could manage of the postman's high, cracked voice. "He got out a mile back, Herr Burgrave," I quavered. "He was a rude fellow who wanted to go to Schwandorf, and then changed his mind." "Where, you fool? Say exactly where he got down, or I'll wring your neck." "In the wood, this side of Gertrude's cottage, on the left hand. I left him running amongst the trees." I put all the terror I knew into the pipe, and it wasn't all acting. "He means the Henrik's cottage, Herr Colonel," said the chauffeur. "This man is courting the daughter." Stum gave an order, and the great car backed, and, as I looked round, I saw it turning. Then, as it gathered speed, it shot forward and presently was lost in the shadows. I'd got over the first hurdle. But there was no time to be lost. Stum would meet the postman, and would be tearing after me any minute. I took the first turning, and bucketed along a narrow woodland road. The hard ground would show very few tracks, I thought, and I hoped the pursuit would think I had gone on to Schwandorf. But it wouldn't do to risk it, and I was determined very soon to get the car off the road, leave it, and take to the forest. I took out my watch and calculated I could give myself 10 minutes. I was very nearly caught. Presently, I came on a bit of rough heath, with a slope away from the road and here and there a patch of black which I took to be a sandpit. Opposite one of these, I slewed the car to the edge, got out, started it again, and saw it pitch head foremost into the darkness. There was a splash of water, and then silence. Craning over, I could see nothing but murk, and the marks at the lip where the wheels had passed. They would find my tracks in daylight, but scarcely at this time of night. Then I ran across the road to the forest. I was only just in time, for the echoes of the splash had hardly died away when I heard the sound of another car. I lay flat in the hollow below the tangle of snow-laden brambles and looked between the pine trees at the moonlit road. It was Stum's car again, and to my consternation it stopped just a little short of the sandpit. I saw an electric torch flashed, and Stum himself got out and examined the tracks on the highway. Thank God they would still be there for him to find, but had he tried half a dozen yards on, he would have seen them turn towards the sandpit. If that had happened, he would have beaten the adjacent woods and most certainly have found me. There was a third man in the car, with my hat and coat on him. That poor devil of a postman had paid dear for his vanity. They took a long time before they started again, and I was jolly well relieved when they went scouring down the road. I ran deeper into the woods till I found a track which, as I judge from the sky which I saw in a clearing, took me nearly due west. That wasn't the direction I wanted, so I bore off at right angles and presently struck another road which I crossed in a hurry. After that I got entangled in some confounded kind of enclosure and had to climb paling after paling of rough stakes platted with osiers. Then came a rise in the ground and I was on a low hill of pines which seemed to last for miles. All the time I was going at a good pace, and before I stopped to rest I calculated I'd put 6 miles between me and the sandpit. My mind was a little more active now. For the first part of the journey I had simply staggered from impulse to impulse. These impulses had been uncommonly lucky, but I couldn't go on like that forever. Excel and plan mark, says the old boar when he gets into trouble, and it was up to me now to make a plan. As soon as I began to think, I saw the desperate business I was in for. Here was I, with nothing except what I stood up in, including a coat and cap that weren't mine, alone in midwinter in the heart of South Germany. There was a man behind me, looking for my blood, and soon there would be a hue and cry for me up and down the land. I'd heard that the German police were pretty efficient, and I couldn't see that I stood the slimmest chance. If they caught me, they would shoot me, beyond doubt. I asked myself, on what charge? And answered, for knocking about a German officer. They couldn't have me up for espionage, for, as far as I knew, they had no evidence. I was simply a Dutchman that had got riled and run amok. But if they cut down a cobbler for laughing at a second lieutenant, which is what happened at Zabern, I calculated that hanging would be too good for a man that had broken a colonel's jaw. To make things worse, my job was not to escape, though that would have been hard enough, but to get to Constantinople, more than 1,000 miles off, and I reckoned I couldn't get there as a tramp. I had to be sent there, and now I'd flung away my chance. If I'd been a Catholic, I would have said a prayer to St. Teresa, for she would have understood my troubles. My mother used to say that when you felt down on your luck, it was a good cure to count your mercies. So I set about counting mine. The first was that I was well started on my journey, for I couldn't be above 80 miles from the Danube. The second was that I had Stumm's Pass. I didn't see how I could use it, but there it was. Lastly, I had plenty of money. 53 English sovereigns and the equivalent of £3 in German paper, which I changed at the hotel. And also, I had squared accounts with old Stumm. That was the biggest mercy of all. I thought I'd better get some sleep, so I found a dryish hole below an oak root and squeezed myself into it. The snow lay deep in these woods, and I was sopping wet up to the knees. All the same, I managed to sleep for some hours, and got up and shook myself just as the winter's dawn was breaking through the treetops. Breakfast, that was the next thing, and I must find some sort of dwelling. Almost at once I struck a road, a big highway running north and south. I trotted along in the bitter morning to get my circulation started, and presently I began to feel a little better. In a little I saw a church spire, which meant a village. Stumm wouldn't be likely to have got onto my tracks yet, I calculated, but there was always the chance that he had warned all the villages round by telephone, and that they might be on the lookout for me. But that risk had to be taken, for I must have food. It was the day before Christmas, I remembered, and people would be holidaying. The village was quite a big place, and at this hour, just after 8 o'clock, there was nobody in the street except a wandering dog. I chose the most unassuming shop I could find, where a little boy was taking down the shutters, one of those general stores where they sell everything. The boy fetched a very old woman who hobbled in from the back, fitting on her spectacles. "Grüß Gott," she said in a friendly voice, and I took off my cap. I saw from my reflection in a saucepan that I looked moderately respectable in spite of my night in the woods. I told her the story of how I was walking from Schwandorf to see my mother at an imaginary place called Judenfield, banking on the ignorance of these villagers about any place 5 miles from their homes. I said my luggage had gone astray, and I hadn't time to wait for it, since my leave was short. The old lady was sympathetic and unsuspecting. She sold me 1 pound of chocolate, 1 box of biscuits, the better part of a ham, and 2 tins of sardines and a rucksack to carry them. I also bought some soap, a comb, and a cheap razor, and a small tourist's guide published by a Leipzig firm. As I was leaving, I saw what seemed like garments hanging up at the back of the shop, and turned to have a look at them. They were the kind of thing that Germans wear on their summer walking tours, long shooting capes made of green stuff they call Loden. I brought one, and a green felt hat, and an alpenstock to keep it company, then wished the old woman and her belongings a Merry Christmas. I departed, and took the shorter cut out of the village. There were one or two people about now, but they did not seem to notice me. I went into the woods again and walked for 2 miles until I halted for breakfast. I was not feeling quite so fit now, and I did not make much of my provisions, beyond eating a biscuit and some chocolate. I felt very thirsty and longed for hot tea. In an icy pool I washed with infinite agony and shaved my beard. That razor was the worst of its species, and my eyes were running all the time with the pain of the operation. Then I took off the postman's coat and his cap and buried them below some bushes. I was now a clean-shaven German pedestrian with a green cape and a hat, and an absurd walking stick with an iron-shod end, the sort of person who roams in thousands over the fatherland in summer, but is a rarish bird midwinter. The tourist guide was a fortunate purchase, for it contained a big map of Bavaria which gave me my bearings. I was certainly not 40 miles from the Danube, more like 30. The road through the village I had left would have taken me to it. I had only to walk south, and I would reach it before night. So far as I could make out, there were long tongues of forest running down to that river, and I resolved to keep to the woodlands. At the worst, I would meet a forester or two, and I had good enough story for them. On the high road, there could be awkward questions. When I started out again, I felt very stiff, and the cold seemed to be growing intense. This puzzled me, for I had minded it not much up to now, and being warm-blooded by nature, it never used to worry me. A sharp winter night on the high veld was a long sight chillier than anything I had struck so far in Europe. But now, my teeth were chattering, and the marrow seemed to be freezing in my bones. The day had started bright and clear, but a rack of grey cloud soon covered the sky, and a wind from the east began to whistle. As I stumbled along through the snowy undergrowth, I kept longing for bright, warm places. I thought of those long days on the veld when the earth was like a great yellow bowl, with white roads running to the horizon, and a tiny white farm basking in the heart of it, with its blue dam and patches of bright green lucerne. I thought of those baking days on the east coast, when the sea was like mother of pearl and the sky one burning turquoise. But most of all, I thought of warm scented noons on the trek, when one dozed in the shadow of the wagon and sniffed the wood smoke from the fire where the boys were cooking dinner. From these pleasant pictures, I returned to the beastly present. The thick snowy woods, the lowering sky, wet clothes, a hunted present, and a dismal future. I felt miserably depressed, and I couldn't think of any mercies to count. It struck me that I might be falling sick. About midday, I awoke with a start to the belief that I was being pursued. I cannot explain how or why the feeling came, except that it is a kind of instinct that men get who have lived much in the wild countries. My senses, which had been numbed, suddenly grew keen, and my brain began to work double quick. I asked myself what I would do if I were stumped, with hatred in my heart and a broken jaw to avenge, and pretty well limitless powers. He must have found the car in the sandpit, and seen my tracks in the wood opposite. I didn't know how good he and his men might be at following a spoor, but I knew that any ordinary Kaffir could have nosed it out easily. But he didn't need to do that. This was a civilized country full of roads and railways. I must sometime and somewhere come out of these woods. He would have all the roads watched, and the telephone would be setting everyone on my track within a radius of 50 miles. Besides, he would soon pick up my trail in the village I'd visited that morning. From the map, I learned that it was called Grief, and it was likely to live up to that name with me. Presently, I came to a rocky knoll which rose out of the forest. Keeping well in shelter, I climbed to the top and cautiously looked around me. Away to the east, I saw the vale of a river with broad fields and church spires. West and south, The forest rolled unbroken in the wilderness of snowy treetops. There was no sign of life anywhere, not even a bird. But I knew very well that behind me in the woods were men moving swiftly on my track, and that it was pretty well impossible for me to get away. There was nothing for it but to go on until I dropped or was taken. I shaped my course south with a shade of west in it, for the map showed me that in that direction I would soonest strike the Danube. What I was going to do when I got there, I didn't trouble to think. I'd fix the river as my immediate goal, and the future must take care of itself. I was now certain that I had fever on me. It was still in my bones as a legacy from Africa, and had come out once or twice when I was with the battalion in Hampshire. The bouts had been short, for I'd known of their coming and dosed myself. But now I had no quinine, and it looked as if I were in for a heavy go. It made me feel desperately wretched and stupid, and for all that, I all but blundered into capture. For suddenly I came on a road and was going to cross it blindly when a man rode slowly past on a bicycle. Luckily, I was in the shade of a clump of hollies, and he was not looking my way, though he was not 3 yards off. I crawled forward to reconnoitre. I saw about half a mile of road running straight through the forest, and every 200 yards was a cyclist. They wore uniform and appeared to be acting as sentries. This could only have one meaning. Stumm had picketed all the roads and cut me off in an angle of the woods. There was no chance of getting across unobserved. As I lay there with my heart sinking, I had the horrible feeling that the pursuit might be following me from behind, and that at any moment I would be enclosed between two fires. For more than an hour I stayed there with my chin in the snow. I didn't see any way out, and I was feeling so ill that I didn't seem to care. And then my chance came suddenly out of the skies. The wind rose, and a great gust of snow blew from the east. In 5 minutes it was so thick that I couldn't see across the road. At first I thought it was a new addition to my troubles, and then very slowly I saw the opportunity. I slipped down the bank and made ready to cross. I almost blundered into one of the bicyclists. He cried out and fell off his machine, but I didn't wait to investigate. A sudden access of strength came to me, and I darted into the woods on the further side. I knew I would soon be swallowed from sight in the drift, and I knew that the falling snow would help hide my tracks, so I put my best foot forwards. I must have run for miles before the hot fit passed, and suddenly I fell from sheer bodily weakness. There was no sound except the crush of falling snow. The wind seemed to have gone, and the place was very solemn and quiet. But heavens, how the snow fell! It was partly screened by the branches, but all the same, it was piling itself up in deep everywhere. My legs seemed to be made of lead, my head burned, and there were fiery pains all over my body. I stumbled on blindly, without a notion of direction, determined only to keep going to the last. For I knew that if at once I lay down, I would never rise again. When I was a boy, I was fond of fairy tales, and most of the stories I remembered had been about great German forests and snow and charcoal burners and woodmen's huts. Once I had longed to see these things, and now I was fairly in the thick of them. There had been wolves too, and I wondered idly if I should fall in with a pack. I felt myself getting light-headed. I fell repeatedly, and laughed silly every time. Once I dropped into a hole and lay for some time at the bottom, giggling. If anyone had found me, he would have taken me for a madman. The twilight of the forest grew dimmer, but I scarcely noticed it. Evening was falling, and soon it would be night, a night without morning for me. My body was going on without the direction of my brain, for my mind was filling with craziness. I was like a drunk man who keeps running, for he knows that if he stops he will fall, and I had a sort of bet with myself not to lie down, not at any rate just yet. If I lay down, I should feel the pain in my head worse. Once, I'd ridden for 5 days down country with fever on me, and the flat bush trees had seemed to melt into one big mirage and dance quadrilles before my eyes. But then, I had more or less kept my wits. Now, I was fairly daft, and every minute growing dafter. And then the trees seemed to stop, and I was walking on flat ground. It was a clearing, and before me twinkled a little light. The change restored me to consciousness, and suddenly I felt with horrid intensity the fire in my head and bones and the weakness of my limbs. I longed to sleep, and I had a notion that a place to sleep was before me. I moved towards the light and presently saw through a screen of snow the outline of a cottage. I had no fear, only an intolerable longing to lie down. Very slowly I made my way to the door and knocked. My weakness was so great that I could hardly lift my hand. There were voices within, and a corner of the curtain was lifted from the window. Then the door opened and a woman stood before me, a woman with a thin, kindly face. "Grüß Gott," she said, while children peeped from behind her skirts. "Grüß Gott," I replied. I leaned against the doorpost, and speech forsook me. She saw my condition. "Come in, sir," she said. "You are sick, and it is no weather for a sick man." I stumbled after her, and stood dripping in the centre of a little kitchen, while three wondering children stared at me. It was a poor place, scantily furnished, but a good log fire burned on the hearth. The shock of warmth gave me one of those minutes of self-possession which come sometimes in the middle of a fever. "I am sick, mother, and I have walked far in the storm and lost my way. I am from Africa, where the climate is hot, and your cold brings me fever. It will pass in a day or two if you can give me a bed." "You are welcome," she said, "but first I will make you coffee." I took off my dripping cloak and crouched close to the hearth. She gave me coffee, poor, washy stuff, but blessedly hot. Poverty was spelled large in everything I saw. I felt the tides of fever beginning to overflow my brain again, and I made a great attempt to set my affairs straight before I was overtaken. With difficulty, I took out Stumm's pass from my pocketbook. "That is my warrant," I said. "I am a member of the Imperial Secret Service, and for the sake of my work I must move in the dark. If you will permit it, mother, I will sleep till I am better, but no one must know that I'm here. If anyone comes, you must deny my presence." She looked at the big seal as if it were a talisman. "Yes, yes," she said, "you will have the bed in the garret and be left in peace till you are well. We have no neighbours near and the storm will shut the roads. I will be silent, I and the little ones." My head was beginning to swim, but I made one more effort. "There is food in my rucksack, biscuits and ham and chocolate. Pray, take it for your use. And here is some money to buy Christmas fare for the little ones." And I gave her some of the German notes. After that, my recollection becomes dim. She helped me up a ladder to the garret, undressed me, and gave me a thick, coarse nightgown. I seem to remember that she kissed my hand, and that she was crying. "The good Lord has sent you," she said. "Now the little ones will have their prayers answered, and the Christkind will not pass by our door." Today's music is a 1929 track by Jackie Taylor. It's called "That's What I Like About You."
Boy, nothing to gentle temperamental.
So the war has ended. But Mr. West's friend is being questioned by the police. Part 6. The Tomb Legions. When Dr. Herbert West disappeared a year ago, the Boston police questioned me closely. They suspected that I was holding something back and perhaps suspected graver things. But I could not tell them the truth because they would not have believed it. They knew, indeed, that West had been connected with activities beyond the credence of ordinary men. For his hideous experiments in the reanimation of dead bodies had long been too extensive to admit of perfect secrecy. But the final, soul-shattering catastrophe held elements of demonic fantasy which make even me doubt the reality of what I saw. I was West's closest friend and only confidential assistant. We had met before in medical school, and from the first I had shared his terrible researches. He'd slowly tried to perfect a solution which, injected into the veins of a newly deceased, would restore life, a labour demanding an abundance of fresh corpses, and therefore involving the most unnatural actions. Still more shocking were the products of some of the experiments. Grisly masses of flesh that had been dead but that West waked to a blind, brainless, nauseous animation. These were the usual results. For in order to reawaken the mind, it was necessary to have specimens so absolutely fresh that no decay could possibly affect the delicate brain cells. This need for very fresh corpses had been West's moral undoing. They were hard to get, and one awful day he had secured his specimen while it was still alive and vigorous. A struggle, a needle, and a powerful alkaloid had transformed it into a very fresh corpse, and the experiment had succeeded for a brief and memorable moment. But West had emerged with a soul calloused and seared, and a hardened eye which sometimes glanced with a kind of hideous and calculating appraisal at men of especially sensitive brain and especially vigorous physique. Toward the last, I became acutely afraid of West, for he began to look at me that way. People did not notice his glances, but they noticed my fear, and after his disappearance used that as a basis for some absurd suspicions. West, in reality, was more afraid than I, for his abominable pursuits entailed a life of furtiveness and dread of every shadow. Partly it was the police he feared, but sometimes his nervousness was deeper and more nebulous, touching on certain indescribable things into which he had injected a morbid life, and from which he had not seen that life depart. He usually finished his experiments with a revolver, but a few times he had not been quick enough. There was that first specimen on whose rifled grave marks of clawing were later seen. There was also that Arkham professor's body, which had done cannibal things before it had been captured and thrust unidentified into a madhouse cell at Sefton, where it beat the walls for 16 years. Most of the other possible surviving results were things less easy to speak of. For in later years, West's scientific zeal had degenerated to an unhealthy and fantastic mania, and he'd spent his chief skill in vitalizing not entire human bodies, but isolated parts of bodies, or parts joined to organic matter other than human. It had become fiendishly disgusting by the time he disappeared. Many of the experiments could not even be hinted at in print. The Great War, through which both of us served as surgeons, had intensified this side of West. In saying that West's fear of his specimens was nebulous, I have in mind particularly its complex nature. Part of it came merely from knowing of the existence of such nameless monsters, while another part arose from apprehension of the bodily harm they might, under certain circumstances, do him. Their disappearance added horror to the situation. Of them all, West knew the whereabouts of only one, the pitiful asylum thing. And then there was a more subtle fear, a very fantastic sensation resulting from a curious experiment in the Canadian Army in 1915. West, in the midst of a severe battle, had reanimated Major Sir Eric Morland Clapham Lee, DSO, a fellow physician who knew about his experiments and could have duplicated them. The head had been removed so that the possibilities of quasi-intelligent life in the trunk might be investigated. Just as the building was wiped out by a German shell, there had been a success. The trunk had moved intelligently, and unbelievable to relate, we were both sickeningly sure that articulate sounds had come from the detached head as it lay in a shadowy corner of the laboratory. The shell had been merciful, in a way, but Wes could never feel as certain as he wished that we too were the only survivors. He used to make shuddering conjectures about the possible actions of a headless physician with the power of reanimating the dead. West's last quarters were in a venerable house of much eloquence, overlooking one of the oldest burying grounds in Boston. He'd chosen the place for purely symbolic and fantastically aesthetic reasons, since most of the interments were of the colonial period and therefore of little use to a scientist seeking very fresh bodies. The laboratory was in a subcellar, secretly constructed by imported workmen, and contained a huge incinerator for the quiet and complete disposal of such bodies, or fragments and synthetic mockeries of bodies, as might remain from the morbid experiments and unhallowed amusements of the owner. During the evacuation of this cellar, the workmen had struck some exceedingly ancient masonry, undoubtedly connected with the old burying ground, yet far too deep to correspond with any known sepulchre therein. After a number of calculations, West decided that it represented some secret chamber beneath the tomb of the Avervilles, where the last interment had been made in 1768. I was with him when he studied the nitrous-dripping walls laid bare by the spades and mattocks of the men, and was prepared for the gruesome thrill which would attend the uncovering of centuried grave secrets. But for the first time, West's new timidity conquered his natural curiosity, and he betrayed his degenerating fibre by ordering the masonry left intact and plastered over. Thus it remained till that final hellish night, part of the walls of that secret laboratory. I speak of West's decadence, and must add that it was a purely mental and intangible thing. Outwardly, he was the same to the last, calm, cold, slight, and yellow-haired, with spectacled blue eyes and a general aspect of youth which years and fears seemed never to change. He seemed calm even when he thought of that clawed grave and looked over his shoulder, even when he thought of the carnivorous thing that gnawed and pawed at Sefton Bars. The end of Herbert West began one evening in our joint study when he was dividing his curious glance between the newspaper and me. A strange headline item had struck at him from the crumpled papers with a nameless titan claw that seemed to reach down through 16 years. Something fearsome and incredible had happened at Sefton Asylum, 50 miles away, stunning the neighbourhood and baffling the police. In the small hours of a morning, a body of silent men had entered the grounds, and their leader had aroused the attendants. He was a menacing military figure who talked without moving his lips and whose voice seemed almost ventriloquially connected with an immense black case he carried. His expressionless face was handsome to the point of radiant beauty, but had shocked the superintendent when the hall light fell on it, for it was a wax face with eyes of painted glass. Some nameless accident had befallen this man. A larger man guided his steps, a repellent hulk whose bluish face seemed half eaten away by some unknown malady. The speaker had asked for the custody of the cannibal monster committed from Arkham 16 years before, and upon being refused, gave a signal which precipitated a shocking riot. The fiends had beaten, trampled, and bitten every attendant who did not flee, killing 4, and finally succeeding in liberation of the monster. Those victims who could recall the event without hysteria swore that the creatures had acted less like men than like unthinkable automata, guided by the wax-faced leader. By the time help could be summoned, every trace of the men and of their mad charge had vanished. From the hour of reading this item until midnight, Wes sat almost paralyzed. At midnight, the doorbell rang, startling him fearfully. All the servants were asleep in the attic, so I answered the bell. As I've told the police, there was no wagon in the street, but only a group of strange-looking figures bearing a large square box which they deposited in the hallway, after one of them had grunted in a highly unnatural voice, "Express, prepaid." They filed out of the house with a jerky tread, and as I watched them go, I had an odd idea that they were turning towards the ancient cemetery, on which the back of the house abutted. When I slammed the door after them, West came downstairs and looked at the box. It was about 2 feet square and bore West's correct name and present address. It also bore the inscription, "From Eric Morland Clapham Lee, St. Eloy, Flanders." 6 years before, in Flanders, a shelled hospital had fallen upon the headless reanimated trunk of Dr. Clapham Lee, and upon the detached head which, perhaps, had uttered articulate sounds. Wes was not even excited now. His condition was more ghastly. Quickly, he said, "It's the finish, but let's incinerate this." We carried the thing down to the laboratory, listening. I do not remember any particulars, you can imagine my state of mind. But it is a vicious lie to say that it was Herbert West's body which I put into the incinerator. We both inserted the whole unopened wooden box, closed the door and started the electricity. Nor did any sound come from the box after all. It was West who first noticed the falling plaster on that part of the wall where the ancient tomb masonry had been covered up. I was going to run, but he stopped me. And then I saw a small black aperture, felt a ghoulish wind of ice and smelled the charnel bowels of a putrescent earth. There was no sound, but just then the electric lights went out and I saw outlined against the phosphorescence of the netherworld a horde of silent, toiling things which only insanity or worse could create. Their outlines were human, semi-human, fractionally human, and not human at all. The horde was grotesquely heterogeneous. They were removing the stones quietly, one by one, from the sentried wall. And then, as the breach became large enough, they came out into the laboratory in single file, led by a talking thing with a beautiful head made of wax. A sort of mad-eyed monstrosity behind the leader seized on Herbert West. West did not resist or utter a sound, and then they all sprang at him and tore him to pieces before my eyes, bearing the fragments away into the subterranean vault of fabulous abominations. West's head was carried off by the wax-headed leader, who wore a Canadian officer's uniform. As it disappeared, I saw that the blue eyes behind the spectacles were hideously blazing with their first touch of frantic, visible emotion. Servants found me unconscious in the morning. West was gone. The incinerator contained only unidentifiable ashes. Detectives have questioned me, but what can I say? The Sefton tragedy, they will not connect with West, nor that, nor the men with the box whose existence they deny. I told them of the vault, and they pointed to the unbroken plaster wall and laughed. So I told them no more. They imply that I am either a madman or a murderer. Probably I am mad. But I might not be mad if those accursed tomb legions had not been so silent. Well, that's it for today. And probably that was it for Herbert as well, actually. Except I want to tell you that I've released an audiobook of the second volume of Charles O'Mann's History of the Peninsular War on Audible. This second volume, like the first, runs for over 27 hours and should get anybody through some sleepless nights. Opening music was provided by Victor Valdez from The Symbol Project. This file is released on an attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Until next time.
cthulhupodcast.co.uk.